know, doing that at the end of the lecture. Okay, I'm just going to write down a couple of the key equations we had this morning. Okay, so definition, the true official definition for the extrinsic curvature. So we had that, and then we had the Gauss-Kadatsky equations. Let's see, I don't think I'll write the other one too. And we had the contracted ones. Right, so I think those were the important results that I derived this morning. So so what I want to do this afternoon, as I told you, was to first of all consider a couple of examples. Well, I have, I think, five of them or something like that, of surfaces that are embedded in a higher dimensional, either space or space-time. So I'll start from a low dimension example, and then we'll move up to real happy surfaces in space-time, just to show you the mechanics involved in computing these things and checking the meaning and validity of the Gauss-Kadatsky equations. And then what I want to do is to have a brief discussion of the initial value problem in GR, and then if I have time, I'll start talking about the junction conditions. Okay, so let's talk about a couple of examples of extrinsic curvature. And that's what I meant to write. And the first one is one that I, well, mentioned before. That's the 2D sphere in 3D flat space. That's a simple, concrete example of some of the issues that, that I've talked about. So, well, here's our three-dimensional space, X, Y, and Z. And I'm going to draw a sphere. It's going to be a sphere of, you know, radius r, say. And on the sphere, I'm going to place the usual intrinsic coordinates, which are going to be the lines of longitudes and the lines of latitudes. So theta and phi are going to be our usual polar coordinates on the surface of the sphere. And while we have a bunch of defining relations for the surface of the sphere, I can take my scalar function phi that defines the sphere to be x squared plus y squared plus z squared minus r squared equals 0. So that would be one way of defining the surface of the sphere, and that's a useful one. Or I can write down, as I did a while back, parametric equations, which are simply a relationship between the coordinates of the larger space in relation to the coordinates that you place on the smaller, the lower dimensional space. And this is the equation that allows us to find the normal vector easily, and those are the relations that allow us to find the tangential vectors easily. So the normal vector is going to be proportional to the gradient of phi, and if I just calculate them all, the gradient of x squared is going to be proportional to x, the gradient of y squared is going to be proportional to y, and the gradient of z squared is going to be proportional to z. I'm forgetting about the factor of 2, but I have to remember to normalize this. So after normalization, what I have expressed in the full set of coordinates is, the usual expression for the radial vector in terms of the original Cartesian coordinates. And if I want, I could rewrite this in terms of the intrinsic coordinates, and the expression will look a little bit simpler. Then we would have a unit vector in the theta direction. So we have two tangential vectors, one in the direction of theta, the other one in the direction of phi, and we get them by taking the partial derivatives of x, y, and z relative to with respect to theta and phi. And in the first instance, we get r cosine theta cosine phi. We have r cosine theta sine phi, and then we get minus r sine theta. So that's the unit vector that points in the direction of theta, and the unit vector that points in the direction of phi, is going to be given by minus r sine theta sine phi, r sine theta cosine phi, and 0. And that gives us a complete vectorial basis on the sphere, two tangential vectors and one normal vector. So once we have that, we can compute everything that follows from that, the intrinsic metric and also the extrinsic curvature. So the intrinsic metric, we get in the usual way by starting with the larger metric and constructing the inner products of all the basis vectors. And that's a straightforward calculation. You just do it, and you find that the intrinsic metric using theta and phi as coordinates, is just going to be given by r squared and r squared. So it's a diagonal metric, which has the usual form for the metric on a two-sphere. So it just, it just follows from the calculation if you didn't know any better. And then for the extrinsic curvature, now what you do is you take your normal vector and you evaluate all of its covariant derivatives in the flat space-time metric, not space-time, the flat space metric, which means that we only worry here about partial derivatives, and you just take all the projections down to the hypersurface, the surface in this case. So you just calculate this, you just go through the computations, and I won't go through the details here because it's all very straightforward, and I would do it with Maple anyway, so no need to worry about the details. But here also, you find that you get something that is diagonal, and the entries here in the theta direction, you get r, and in the phi direction, you get r sine squared theta. And a neat way to express this is to say that the extrinsic curvature is, a constant factor times the metric itself. And that's not a surprising result, because the sphere is about as symmetrical as you can make it. And therefore, there's only so many tensorial structures you can generate on the surface of the sphere, and the metric basically is it. So any two-index tensor that lives on the sphere will have to be proportional to the metric. And in fact, higher ranked tensors will also be expressed in terms of, you know, products of the metric tensor. So I'll just write down in a second an expression for the Riemann tensor on the sphere, and it's going to be written neatly in terms of the metric on the sphere. One aspect of this, one consequence of this is that, well, the extrinsic curvature is covariantly constant on the surface of the sphere. And that's good, because that guarantees that when we test the validity of the Gauss-Kudesz equation, this one, well, we'll get a zero right-hand side over here, because we know that, you know, in three-dimensional flat space, the left-hand side is zero. So that was something that was sort of, well, you know, given that all of those guys are zero, guarantees then that, as expected, the Riemann tensor of three-dimensional flat space is zero. Over here, we still need a zero on the left-hand side, and the way to achieve this is to recognize that the Riemann tensor on the sphere is non-zero, but it's going to be equal, apart from a minus sign, to this combination of extrinsic curvatures, which means that the Riemann tensor is going to be proportional to a bunch of metric tensors all packaged together. That's what I was talking about when I said that there's only so many tensorial structures you can put on the sphere, and the metric is pretty much all that you got. So continuing along those lines, well, you could take this two-dimensional metric and calculate the Riemann tensor associated with that, and you end up with the following expression. So the intrinsic Riemann tensor on the two-dimensional sphere is just 1 over r squared, and then you get HAC, HBD, minus HAD, HBC. And that is exactly the right product of k's to guarantee that the right-hand side to that equation is zero. And here's an interesting, you know, balance between extrinsic curvature and intrinsic curvature, combining in just the right way to produce no curvature in the embedding space. So that's, you know, that's one of the, you know, consequences of the Gauss-Kudesz equation, is that you can have curved surfaces in a flat space, provided that the intrinsic curvature and the extrinsic curvature do the right thing. Right?
Sorry, one question. E alpha theta, for example, is supposed to be a unit vector, right?
No. They're not. Yeah. No, they're not unit vectors because they have to generate the metric. And well, the metric is going to be, you know, the inner product of the vectors is going to be what generates the metric. Typically, in three-dimensional vector calculus, we always convert these things into unit vectors, which is something that, well, is useful for certain purposes, but not for what we're doing here. Yeah, yeah. So the partial derivatives, the tangential vectors, are, you know, on purpose defined to be non-unit vectors because of this key relationship here between the space-time metric and the intrinsic metric. So other questions about this example? Okay, so that's, you know, that's, I think, a very straightforward thing. And the only, you know, the only mildly challenging aspect of doing this calculation is to actually take these components for the normal vector and calculate all the derivatives and all the projections. And again, that's something that you can do very easily with MAPLE. You know, there's nothing really very challenging about that at all in this case. Okay, so that was example number one. So let's look at example number two. Here I'll take, instead of a sphere, I'll talk about a cylinder. So still in 2D. And well, here the situation is a bit different because the cylinder, as you know, is a flat surface. So here's a situation where we'll deal with both. So we'll deal with, well, essentially a trivial situation where this is going to be zero all by itself. This is going to be zero all by itself. and 0 equals 0. 0 plus 0 is going to give us the 0 left-hand side that we need for a flat space embedding. So, here's the three-dimensional space, and a cylinder can be drawn like this. And it's going to be a cylinder of radius r. The defining surface for the cylinder, I might describe it as this. And what I might use for intrinsic coordinates on the cylinder, it might be a good idea to use z, because it's a nice coordinate to be used on the axis. And around the circular directions, I might as well use an angle. So I'll use an angle phi to run around the cylinder. And the parametric equations to describe the cylinder is simply going to be that x is equal to r cosine phi, and y is going to be equal to r sine phi. And then the missing equation is the one that says that z equals z. So z viewed as an intrinsic coordinate. So z viewed in the embedding space is equal to z as viewed on intrinsically on the cylinder. So those are the parametric equations. This is the defining equation. From this equation, we get that the normal vector, apart from a normalization constant, is going to be x, y, and 0. And the normalization constant, of course, will have to be the square root of x squared plus y squared. I won't write it down here. The tangent vectors, there's going to be one going in the z direction, which is going to be 0, 0, 1. And then there's going to be one going in the phi direction, which is going to be the partial derivative of x, y, and z with respect to phi. So we're going to get minus r sine phi, r cosine phi, and 0. So, pretty straightforward. The intrinsic metric obtained by calculating all the inner products will be, again, diagonal. And it's going to be so if I'm, I need to. I'll just write it like this. So, what I should have written is that YA in this case is going to be the collection Z and phi. And if I write down the metric on the sphere, I can write it in this form right here in terms of the line element on the cylinder, not the sphere. And I'm going to be plus R squared D phi squared. And the form for the form, this form for the metric tells us that we are actually dealing with a flat, a space which is intrinsically flat. So topologically, it's interesting because it's a closed space in one dimension, but it's actually intrinsically flat because this metric has no curvature on it. And you know that because you can always unwrap the cylinder and lay it down flat on the, on the flat surface. And the space really is intrinsically flat. So this is the metric of a flat space. And so the curvature, that you would calculate from this would be equal to 0. The extrinsic curvature that you would calculate from the normal vector would be as follows. I'll list the components. Kzz is 0. Kz phi is 0. But k phi phi is not 0. It's 1 over r. It's r. So this is a case where this is a case where the extrinsic curvature is not proportional to the metric. And that's because, this space has less symmetry than the spherical space we had before. So here we do have extrinsic curvature. We have no intrinsic curvature. But it so happens that when you look at this equation right here, that while the symmetries of the Riemann tensor will be such that in this equation, you cannot make B equal to C because, you know, so if you were tempted to put any two of those indices equal to phi, you would find that there would be a cancellation between those two terms, and the combination, therefore, will always equal zero with this listing in components we got. And in this situation, then, we have zero intrinsic curvature. We have extrinsic curvature, but the combination with the minus sign sums up to zero, and then we have the, you know, expected zero equals zero equation in this case. So I should just say that this is a flat metric. Okay, so let's do something a bit more interesting. So here I'll talk about a real space-time and a real hypersurface in space-time, and that is a surface t equal constant in FRW. So in this case, well, first of all, let me say what the metric is in the full four-dimensional space-time. So we have the usual form here, and again, I'll just consider the case where the spatial sections of our universe are flat. So that's going to be the metric in the full space-time, and I'm going to be talking here about a surface t equal constant, which means that, well, the induced metric is going to be obtained by, you know, restricting the displacement such that, you know, dt is equal to zero, and therefore the induced metric on my hypersurfaces are just going to be given by, well, a scale factor evaluated at a certain time times the flat metric. So here's a case where, again, the flat, the hypersurface that I'm defining by the statement t equal constant is actually a flat space. Okay, so the defining equation in this case is that, well, the equation phi that defines the hypersurface, you know, would be simply phi equals t minus the constant if I want phi equals zero to be the description of my hypersurface. And then the parametric equations, well, we might as well stick with x, y, and z as coordinates on our hypersurface, which means that in this case the parametric equations are trivial. They just say that, well, x in the space-time is the same thing as x on the hypersurface, y in the space-time is the same thing as y on the hypersurface, and same thing for z. And from all of this, well, we get an expression for the normal vector. The normal vector is going to be minus 1 in the time entry and 0 everywhere else. And then we have the tangential vectors, which have the, you know, the usual 1 entries everywhere. And that's an example of a space-time which is everywhere written in terms of Gaussian normal coordinates. So the construction that I had before, which was, you know, thought, you know, in general to be restricted to a neighborhood of the hypersurface, here in fact can be extended globally. That's exactly the same type of coordinate construction that here applies to the whole universe. Okay, so here we have the normal vector and the tangential vector, so we just repeat the, you know, the procedure. And let's see. I don't know what to do. Well, I'll go over there. So in this case, then, the induced metric on the hypersurface, well, is very easy to get. It's simply a squared evaluated at a specific time multiplying the coordinate displacements And the extrinsic curvature in this case, well, we calculate it in the usual way by looking at our normal vector, differentiating it, and projecting it. And in this case, what we find is that, well, we would expect that the space is so symmetrical that all the components of the extrinsic curvature should be equal to each other. And sure enough, what we find in this case is that kxx equals kyy equals kzz, and they're all equal to a times a dot, all evaluated on the hypersurface. And another way of writing this down is to say that kab is going to be a dot over a times the induced metric. A dot over a is not a function of time in this case. A dot over a is evaluated at a specific time, so it's just a constant factor. And while you may recognize this as the Hubble parameter, right? H, the Hubble parameter H, which, you know, changes as the universe expands, is defined to be a dot over a. So k is equal to h times the intrinsic metric in this case. So here we have a situation again where the extrinsic curvature is covariantly constant on the hypersurface because, the spatial metric all by itself is going to be covariantly constant. And this is just a constant factor. There's no spatial dependence here. So we have that condition again holding for the FRW case. We're dealing with flat sections, which means that the intrinsic curvature of that space is equal to zero. And here, the point is that here we have a situation where there is space-time curvature in the space-time. So in this case, the left-hand side is certainly not zero. But in this case, we have no intrinsic curvature. All of the curvature is produced externally. So the space-time curvature on the left-hand side is produced entirely by the k-squared terms. And we could complete the calculation and conclude that the Riemann tensor in space-time would be constructed by, you know, k-squared terms like this. So it would go like the square of the Hubble parameter. I won't go through those steps. I think you see how it would go. There's something interesting here about this relationship. There's no indication that our universe is ever going to recollapse, but, you know, let's pretend it would do that. Let's pretend it did that. Well, if there's a moment where the universe stops expanding and starts recontracting, we have an instant of time in the history of the universe where a dot is zero, right? That's a turning point in the history of the universe. That's a moment of time symmetry in the history of the universe where what's going to happen in the future is going to be, well, the mirror image of what happened in the past, or the time reversal of what happened in the past. So if you have a surface like this, if you have a moment of time like that in the history of the universe where you have a reversal like that, where you have a time reversal symmetry about that that moment of time, this is a place where KAB as a tensor will vanish. Well, I just wanted to call attention to that because what I'm going to do in just a moment is define any hypersurface of vanishing extrinsic curvature a moment of time symmetry. And I'll just come back to that a little bit later. But the idea is, I think, very simple. KAB, we remember, is the time derivative of the metric on the hypersurface. If there's, you know, if the evolution of the space-time is such that at some point the metric momentarily comes to a halt, that is, that momentarily the time derivative of the metric is zero, well, that's like, you know, that's like, and count, that's like the situation right here, and it's essentially, that is a description of what you might mean by a moment of time symmetry in the space-time. You have a hypersurface, a space-like hypersurface, on which the time derivative of the metric momentarily vanishes. And that is said geometrically by saying that the extrinsic curvature on that hypersurface vanishes. And that, you know, I'll take that as a definition of what we might mean by a moment of time symmetry in the history of the universe, or in the history of the space-time, more generally speaking. Okay, so that's a FRW example. Let's do a Schwarzschild example. I'll do two Schwarzschild examples. So the first Schwarzschild example is, so that was number three, this is number four. I'll take a surface T equal constant in Schwarzschild. And we're going to see what we get here. So the space-time metric is the familiar Schwarzschild solution. And well, if we're talking about Schwarzschild, of course, F is going to be equal to 1 minus 2m over r, but I think for my purposes here, I don't really care about whether F is equal to that or not. We could be talking about Schwarzschild or Reisner-Nordström or Schwarzschild de Sitter or de Sitter. All of the cases where the metric can be expressed in this form, whatever the function F, are just as good. Okay. So this is my space-time. I want to consider a hypersurface of constant time, which means that, well, my defining equation, again, would be the phi minus the constant, the function phi that describes the hypersurface should be t minus the constant, and that means that phi is going to be equal to zero on a hypersurface. So that's one of the defining equations. And now I need to make a choice of intrinsic coordinates, and well, I might as well continue to stick with r, theta, and phi as useful intrinsic coordinates on my hypersurface. So YA, we're going to be agreeing, will be chosen to be r, theta, and phi, and the parametric relations, therefore, will just say that, R as viewed in space-time is going to be the same thing as R as viewed on a hypersurface, and so on, and so on. And from all of this, we can figure out what the components of our normal tangential vectors will be. And while the normal vector will only have a time component, and all we have to worry about here is how to properly normalize it, and if I write it with the index down, I'm going to need a factor of square root of f in the denominator. In the time entry, and that follow, and there's going to be a minus sign here if I want my normal vector to be future pointing, and that comes from the fact that, you know, if I normalize this, I'm going to involve the inverse metric, and the inverse to GTT is 1 over f with a minus sign, and that kills off the two factors of the square root of f that appears here. So that's my normal vector. And, you know, that's a function of r on a hypersurface. And then the tangential vectors in this case, there's going to be one pointing in the direction of r, which will have the usual, you know, it's going to be the partial derivative of r with respect to r. So it's going to be one in the r direction and so on. And then there's going to be one in the phi direction. So, okay, so again, so once we have those defining equations, then the rest is just straightforward. And so the intrinsic metric here is very easy to get because we just set dt equal to zero in the full metric, and we get our induced metric. Yeah, you have a question?
Shouldn't that be minus square root of that?
Sorry?
Should the first component of the Galois function be minus square root of that?
Which one?
First component of the Galois.
This is not a unit vector. This one?
Yeah.
Okay, so we have a component in time, in the time direction. And I claim that if I want to, so this is n with the index down, right? So if I normalize this, oh, you're right. Thank you. Right, because when I normalize this, I'll bring the inverse to GTT, which is 1 over f, and 1 over f will multiply square root of f times square root of f. I'll get out of my minus signs, and we're going to get the right answer. So yeah, thank you for correcting me here. OK, so the induced metric then is this metric over here. That's the metric that lives on each surface t equal constant. And well, that's a curved manifold. That's a metric that has curvature, so this is a case where we do have intrinsic curvature in our hypersurface. But when you do the calculation of the extrinsic curvature, any guess? It's zero. Again, the extrinsic curvature is the time derivative of the metric. The metric is static, and b gets zero. So this is a case where we have intrinsic curvature. We don't have any extrinsic curvature. And of course, in this case, the intrinsic curvature will agree with the projected space-time curvature. And in the full Schwarzschild space-time, we'll get non-zero results for these guys, for these components to the full Riemann tensor. But those guys are going to be zero, because the right-hand side to that equation, well, is zero, right? The extrinsic curvature is zero. OK, one last one. Another Schwarzschild example. In this case, I'll take a time-like surface of r equal constant. So this is a case where the hypersurface is going to be time-like, and there's going to be you know, a time component running along it, and we're going to use the two angles to describe the other two intrinsic coordinates. So we're dealing with the same metric, but now the description of the hypersurface is going to be the statement that little r is going to be some constant radius capital R. So in a space-time diagram, that would also be represented by a cylinder. And the circles around the cylinder would be, in fact, well, two spheres. And the coordinate along the axis of the cylinder would be the time coordinate. The parametric equations in this case simply says that, well, we're going to continue to use t, theta, and phi as intrinsic coordinates. There's no reason to do otherwise. And the parametric relations, well, again, t as viewed in space-time is the same t as viewed on the hypersurface, and so on. And in this case, of course, the induced metric is simply going to be, you know, 1 over f. Sorry. minus f dt squared plus r squared. Okay, I should be a bit more careful here. Let me do it in step. So the normal vector is going to be in the direction of r. And the normal vector has to be normalized, which means that here we get square root of f in the denominator for the same reasons that we didn't get it over there. So that's the normal vector. And then the tangential vectors, there's going to be one in direction of t, which has a time entry. And then we'll get the usual ones in direction of theta and phi. And when we take all the inner products and we get the induced metric, we get this. The metric on the hypersurface is going to be minus f evaluated at r multiplying dt squared plus r squared d theta squared plus sine squared d phi squared. So that's the induced metric on the hypersurface. And well, that's a flat space. No, it's not a flat space. It's a two-sphere crossed so it's a three-cylinder. So it has the curvature. So it's flat in this direction, but it's curved in those directions. So it's S2 cross R is what that space is. And you know, this is a space that does have curvature on it. So here we have a situation where we do have intrinsic curvature. And this is also a situation where we have extrinsic curvature, because when you actually calculate the covariant derivatives of that vector, that normal vector, and you project it down, you find, in fact, that the entries are not zero. So in this case, KTT is equal to minus F evaluated at R times the derivative of F evaluated at R. K theta is equal to R multiplying the square root of F evaluated at capital R. And K phi is going to be the same thing, multiplying sine squared theta. So we do have a non-trivial extrinsic curvature on that hypersurface. And that has to do with the fact, that you have to be a little bit careful when you evaluate all the covariant derivatives of the normal vector. You have to think of all the Christoffel symbols that might show up in the calculation, and those will produce all of those terms that you see here. So this is a situation where, if you look at the Gauss-Kadatze equation, this is non-zero. All of that is non-zero, and there's curvature in the full space-time metric. So here, you get you get something non-zero equals something else non-zero, so none of the terms over here are going to be non-zero. And that's true for those terms as well. I'm not so sure. It could be that this equation tells you that zero is equal to zero. But yeah, I think that's true, because there would be no time component to the Riemann tensor with all spatial indices. This would be non-zero as well, so because I'm not talking here about the surface of time symmetry, the surface of constant time. Okay, so anyway, so a bunch of examples that I think illustrate how to compute these things, but you already have some experience in that for the homework assignment. I was assigning you the task of calculating these things for another type of hypersurface living in Schwarzschild space-time, and I hope that you were just as pleased and surprised and delighted when you found out that those hypersurfaces were flat. Did you notice that? Well, if you were not surprised and delighted and amazed by that, think about it, because it's a really amazing result. Okay. All right. Okay. So those were the examples I wanted to show you. And I want to go back to what I said I would talk about, and that's the initial value problem. Okay, well, let's think about something simple first. So, mechanics, Newtonian mechanics. What do we have for dynamical equations in Newtonian mechanics? We have F equals ma, and those are second order differential equations for the position of, you know, everything in our mechanical system. So we have second order differential equations, and what we need to find unique solutions to those equations are two pieces of information, and typically what we take those two pieces of information to be are, you know, the initial positions and the initial velocities of all of our bodies in our mechanical system. So solving the initial value problem in Newtonian mechanics just means, you know, give me initial positions, give me initial velocities, and that's it. And in Newtonian mechanics, there's no difficulty because, you know, you can pick any position you wish, any velocity you wish. Those are always valid choices of initial data. And then, you know, you plug that into your evolution equations, and then you have the positions and velocities for all times after or before. Okay. So in mechanics, solving the initial value problem is really not difficult at all. In field theory, if you have, for example, a Klein-Gordon field, or, you know, a wave equation for a massless scalar field or something like that, you have a slightly more complicated mathematical problem. Now you're solving second-order partial differential equations for your scalar field. Say we're dealing with a massless scalar field that would obey a wave equation of that form, and here it might be in flat space or it might be in curved space-time, I don't really care. So here the situation has to be specified a little bit more precisely. We have second-order partial differential equations, and we have to ask, you know, what is the required amount of information in this case that would allow us to fix the solution uniquely. And the answer is that, well, it's pretty much analogous to what we had in the mechanical case, except that, well, we have to be a little bit more precise in how we say this. And in curved space-time, what you would do is to say, first of all, let's specify what we might mean by the initial surface on which we're going to specify the initial data. And that can be any space-like hypersurface that we might pick. And that's my surface sigma over here. The initial data we need to provide to have a unique solution to that equation, there are two pieces. One is going to be that we have to specify the value of the field everywhere on that hypersurface. Those are the initial values for the field. But another ingredient that we need would be, the time derivative of the field on the hypersurface. So if we're dealing with flat space-time and we place our initial data on a surface of constant time, we would specify the value of the field on that hypersurface, and we would specify the value of its time derivative on that hypersurface, and that would be enough initial data and just the right amount of initial data to specify a unique evolution away from that hypersurface. The wave equation would take this initial data and evolve it forward in time or backwards in time completely uniquely. In this more general situation, while we have to make a little bit more precise what we might mean by time derivative of the field in this case, but we went through that story this morning, and what I really mean by that would be, presumably something like the normal derivative of the field specified everywhere on the hypersurface. And the statement then, it's a theorem of mathematical physics that says that if you want to come up with a unique solution to this in space-time, you have to specify this piece of initial data on the hypersurface and this piece of initial data on the hypersurface, and then you have enough to provide, to specify the solution uniquely. You had a question? So the initial value problem really requires you that you specify the initial data on a space-like surface. If you have a boundary in your space-time that is a time-like boundary, then it becomes a boundary value problem. And that's really tricky because you would have to make sure that the evolution of the field is compatible with the selection of data, with the data that you choose to place on the boundary. And that, that could be difficult. So when you deal with a time-like boundary, you've already decided on the causal behavior of the field on the boundary, and you just have to be sure that the field outside of the boundary agrees to obey, the prescribed data that you placed on the boundary, and that may or may not be possible depending on a certain thing. I'm not sure exactly what the conditions are, but that's a much trickier problem to solve, although I think it can be done. But anyway, I didn't want to discuss those cases because momentarily I don't remember exactly how they are treated. But here, here I'm solving an initial value problem, not a boundary value problem, and I'm really demanding that this hypersurface be space-like. But then once you have that, so once you have the value of the field on the hypersurface, the value of its normal derivative on the hypersurface, then you have initial data to proceed, and the wave equation combined with the initial data will tell you what the solution is everywhere at all times. And one way of actually, doing this in practice is to write, is to use Green's function and to write down the solution in terms of hypersurface integral involving the Green's function and involving those two pieces. You've seen that in the context of Jackson ENM. Not directly in this context, but anyway, those things are pretty well known, well understood, but I won't care to go into that here. The essential message is that a second order PDE for a field requires those pieces of information. You need the initial values, but you also need the time derivatives, and only when you have both of these do you have enough information to specify the solution uniquely. Well, GR is a field theory, and the Einstein field equations are second-order differential equations for the metrics, so presumably everything that I've said here in the case of a scalar field could be said just as well in the case of the metric. And the answer is yes. The answer is that this is true. And in the case of GR, all you would have to do is to, change the symbols. In GR, you would have the Einstein field equations replacing my wave equation. Those are second-order PDEs that require initial data for a unique solution. And what you require here is, something like the value of the metric on the hypersurface and the value of the time derivative of the metric on the hypersurface. Time being understood here as being, the thing that lives in the normal direction. And essentially, that idea is correct. It's just that it's not quite refined enough for our fancy, you know, attitude, where we want to make things well-defined and also geometrically correct. It's not good enough to be politically correct. You have to be geometrically correct. Okay, one issue that's underlying all of this is the fact that, well, we know that the metric is not going to be completely determined by the Einstein field equations. We still have that, all of that freedom at specifying the coordinates. And that means that we have complete freedom at choosing the coordinates on the hypersurface. But in addition to that, we have complete freedom at extending the coordinates off the hypersurface. So there's a lot of, you know, underdetermination in the field equations to allow for this coordinate freedom. Related to that, there's the fact that it wouldn't do to specify all the components of the metric on the hypersurface. Because when you think about this, you know, some of those components actually relate to displacements that would be made on the hypersurface, and that's geometrically correct. But some components here, for example, the time-time component, really characterize displacements that go off the hypersurface, and we don't want to say anything about those because those would have to be pinned down by the evolution equations. So when I say let's specify the values of the metric on the hypersurface, I don't really mean it. I mean, let's specify those components that are geometrically well-defined on the hypersurface. And what that means is that what we're allowed to specify is the induced metric, but no more than that. How we specify the other components of the metric mostly have to do with how we choose to extend the coordinates off the hypersurface, and not with geometrical information on the hypersurface. So we're only going to be specifying that. And, well, for this guy, you know where I'm going. To make that into something geometrically correct, we need to think of specifying not, you know, the time derivative of the metric in some unknown, you know, meaning of time, but we have to, you know, we have to really make that precise by saying that what we're going to be specifying are going to be the induced metric and the extrinsic curvature on the hypersurface. And that way of formulating it is geometrically correct, and it's also the right formulation of the initial value problem in general relativity. And the statement then, and I won't go through any of the proofs of that, I don't even do that in the book, and if you want to go through the proofs, you have to, you know, perhaps look at Wald, or you have to go back to the literature. Shoke Bruha did a lot of work on that, and a lot of mathematicians have studied that to death. But the statement is this, and the theorem, or, you know, the statement that you can make about this is this. Given the nature of the Einstein field equations and the fact that they're PDEs that are nonlinear but linear in the second derivative, so they're quasi-linear PDEs, it's a system of quasi-linear PDEs. Given the nature of the Einstein field equations, the correct amount of initial data that you need to provide on a space like hypersurface for a unique solution, modulo different morphisms and coordinate transformations and all of that, is precisely this and that. The six components of the induced metric, you know, it's a 3x3 matrix that's symmetrical, and the six components of the extrinsic curvature, you need no more than that, but you need all of that. And solving the initial value problem of general relativity just means give me that, give me this. And once I have that, I have enough information to do a complete evolution with complete freedom at how I'm going to pick my coordinates once I go off the hypersurface. The reason why it's not trivial to solve the initial value problem of general relativity is because you cannot pick this at free, you know, at will, and you cannot pick that at will. There are constraint equations that you have to satisfy. And the constraint equations are right here. You have to satisfy the Einstein field equations everywhere in space-time, and in particular, you have to satisfy the Einstein field equations on the hypersurface. And that means that there have to be, you know, there have to be constraints between what you pick for the intrinsic metric and what you pick for the extrinsic curvature. And the constraint equations, I'm going to rewrite them in a second, tells us that, you know, given the matter distribution on a hypersurface, the curvature associated with the intrinsic metric and the extrinsic curvature have to be such that the right-hand side matches the left-hand side, which is given by the distribution of matter on the hypersurface. And there's a similar requirement on how the extrinsic curvature varies from place to place on the hypersurface. Its derivatives are constrained by those components of the Einstein tensor, which tell us something else about the distribution of matter on the hypersurface. Those equations, those equations that come straight out of Einstein's equations that correspond to the normal and normal tangential components of the Einstein tensor, are constraint equations that tell you, you know, what relationships these guys must have in order to be valid solutions to the initial value problem. The remaining Einstein equations, the spatial-spatial Einstein equations, are the ones that will allow you to evolve those initial data to the future or to the past. And remember, those are the pieces that involve second-time derivatives. These guys over here involve the induced metric, its time derivative, but only its first-time derivative. So those are constraints on the initial data. If you want to evolve the initial data to the future or to the past, you need the second derivative part with respect to time. So you need to have field equations that tell you what the second derivatives are doing. And that information is contained not in those pieces of the Einstein field equations, but in the space-space components of the Einstein tensor. Okay, so the end result here, the conclusion is that, well, the actual, specification of initial values in general relativity involve an induced metric and an extrinsic curvature. Those cannot be picked arbitrarily. They have to satisfy certain constraints, and the constraints equation there are two of them. One that says that the Ricci scalar that you would get from the induced metric minus the k pieces, all of that has to be equal to, by virtue of the Einstein field equations, it has to be equal to 16 pi, the normal component to the energy momentum tensor. And that's the energy density seen by observers that move normally to the hypersurface. This is the energy density distribution on the hypersurface. And you would need to specify that, of course. And having specified that, then you would need to guarantee, you would need to make sure that the metric you pick and the extrinsic curvature you pick are such that this equation is satisfied. And in addition to that, you would have to satisfy the other equation that says that the covariant derivative of the extrinsic curvature is constrained by that equation, which says that, and in this case, we have 8 pi, the normal tangential components of the energy momentum tensor. So this is an energy density on the hypersurface. This is, it's a current vector on the hypersurface. So if you have matter flowing across the, within the hypersurface, this is going to be non-zero, and you're going to have this additional constraint on the components of the extrinsic curvature. And those equations are complicated. They're non-linear, obviously, in the metric, non-linear in the extrinsic curvature, and it's a big mess to solve. And, you know, for example, people who do computer simulations of space-times try to set up initial conditions for numerical evolution, the first thing they need to do is to solve that mess. And that's a problem all by itself, and it's a problem that requires a lot of computational resources all by itself. I mean, they only have to solve it once, of course, and they solve it only at one instant of time, but it's a very difficult, very challenging problem to solve. And there's a whole literature I could give an entire course, you know, provided I knew anything about this. I could give an entire course about how to solve the initial value problem for interesting configurations, for example, involving two orbiting black holes or something else, depending on what you want to do. In numerical simulations, people tend to focus on the two black hole problem. They would try to come up with an initial metric and an initial extrinsic curvature that would be a solution to the constraints, but would have the interpretation as describing two black holes in orbital motion around one another. And it's a very challenging thing to do. There's a whole literature, as I said, and you know, and there's a lot of, you know, many mathematicians have studied the, you know, the type of partial differential equations that arise in this context, and you know, and there's been a lot of work put into trying to find not only solutions to those equations, but also physically interesting solutions to those equations. In the black hole problem, in the two black hole problem, there's a source of simplification that has to do with the fact that you don't have matter distributions in your system. You have two black holes. Outside the black holes, you have pure vacuum, and therefore the right-hand sides, you know, for that application, the right-hand sides of the equations is zero. So already that simplifies your life quite a bit. You don't have to worry about the matter distribution, but even with a zero right-hand side, you get something rather you know, complicated to solve. You know, there's been a lot of progress in that, and you know, and people can do that. And in fact, there's some simple prescriptions that that have been devised to do that. But nevertheless, the point remains that, you know, this is a complicated problem all by itself, even before you start doing the evolution. So just to put the initial data in place requires solving this, and after that you still have to worry about how to evolve them forward in time, which is another bag of you know, bag of problems. One strategy you can devise to try to solve those equations, for example, suppose that we have the vacuum situation where the right hand side is zero, wouldn't it be great if you just set KAB equals zero? Then you would simplify the problem. This equation would be 0 equals 0. That would be solved all by itself immediately. And this equation would simplify, you know, drastically, because now you would end up with a single equation for the spatial metric that wouldn't look all that bad anymore. All the nasty k-square terms would be gone, and all you would have to do is to solve for a Ricci flat spacetime in three dimensions. Well, that's a way of generating a solution, right? You try anything that works. Is there any physics behind this? Well, yes, because KAB equals zero is what we said before we mean by a surface of time symmetry. If we set up a situation where we are at a moment of time symmetry, for example, a universe that's just about to recollapse after having expanded, or two black holes that are just about, well, maybe not two black holes, but for example, suppose that you had you know, it's a fictional problem, but suppose you had two blobs of matter that in the past were merged together, but it expands out, you know, two blobs of matter that expand out but then turn around to recollapse again. Well, you could start at a moment of time symmetry where the objects are momentarily at rest, just about to recollapse into each other to form some collapsed body that may turn out to be a black hole. So you could start with two stars at a moment of time symmetry where they're momentarily at rest, and then you would let them, you know, collapse into each other, and that presumably, I mean, that's a situation that might form a black hole at the end of the evolution. Well, those are all good moments of time symmetry, and the idea is that, well, you would model the initial data, you would get the initial data by making this rather, you know, useful assumption that KAB is equal to zero. So, so bottom line is that, you know, for those, you know, situations of time symmetry, what do you mean by that? Well, you mean KAB equals zero, and you have a way of simplifying the structure of the initial value equations, and that's useful. So it's useful, for example, if you have two black holes that are just about to be released from rest and will collide into one another, or two stars that are just about to collapse into each other being released from rest. It's not useful at all for orbiting black holes because, you know, if the black holes are orbiting, time reversal means that they would be orbiting in the opposite direction, so this is not you know, an instant of time symmetry. So for those orbiting situations, KAB is certainly not equal to zero. So for, you know, for more interesting applications, you really have to face, you know, the full problem. In the book, I tried to give you a little, you know, a few of the strategies that I've been sort of explored to find solutions to those equations. I don't go very far, and as I said, you know, whole books could be written about this topic, and review articles have been written about this topic. I think it's a very interesting topic, but, you know, it would take me too much time, and it would go beyond what, you know, the focus of the course really is, which is black holes, to go into that. So I think I'll just, you know, stop my discussion right here. But, you know, the fact that we do have constrained equations, the fact that the initial data for the Einstein field equations is not freely specifiable is a very important part of general relativity. And in that sense, it's not dramatically different from what we got in E&M, because in E&M, you can look at Maxwell's equations and you look at the ones that have time derivatives in them. Those are the evolution equations. You look at the ones that don't have time derivatives in them, those are constraint equations. And one of the constraint equations is the one that says that the divergence of B has to be equal to the charge density. And if you look at Maxwell's equations as, you know, as an evolution system where you specify the initial data on some equal constant surface, well, you would not be able to pick any E as a choice of initial data. You would have to make sure that it satisfies this constraint equation. And in that sense, what we have here is very analogous to that. It's just that here, the nature of the initial value problem is much more complicated. The equations are highly nonlinear and very difficult to solve, whereas, well, for this one, it's not much of a challenge to solve a linear equation that has such a simple mathematical structure. Conceptually, though, there's a lot of analogies between this case in Maxwell's E&M and what we see here for gravity. The final remark that I'll make is that once you've solved the initial value problem, well, the name of the game then is to try to evolve forward in time the metric. So when you move away from the initial value problem and now you consider doing a full evolution, well, the idea here is that you're not just going to have one surfaces of constant time, you're going to have a whole bunch of them. And on each of them, you're going to have an H and an extrinsic curvature. And the idea is that you want the evolution to tell you, having made one choice here, what are going to be the next choices forward in time or backwards in time. So what you need to do that are evolution equations for H and K. And those are not provided by those equations. The evolution equations for these quantities will be given by the remaining components of the Einstein field equations, the spatial components of the Einstein field equations. Those are the equations that tell you how to evolve forward in time the initial data that you placed on one of those hypersurfaces. And when I look at the Hamiltonian formulation of GR, we're going to see that coming out more explicitly. And the constraint equations will be, Hamiltonian constraints, we're going to see that coming back to us from a different point of view. But, of course, the physical content is going to be exactly the same. Here we see it, by just writing down the relevant components of the field equations, we're going to see that happening again. It's going to reappear again, in terms of the Hamiltonian formulation when we get to that. Okay, so any questions about this discussion here? Yep. Harvey?
Well, could you just say again, I mean, this is all modular the diffeomorphism of freedom, right?
Right.
So what you're really saying is that you're taking all the solutions and identifying them and they're related by a diffeomorphism.
Yes. So in order to say this precisely, I would have to say something about the coordinate freedom and that operation modulo diffeomorphisms. In the standard 3+1 approach, you have H and K, but then you have additional quantities, the lapse and the shift vector, that in fact characterize the coordinate freedom that you have at starting from the initial coordinates and continuing them forward in time, or you know, how you how you relate the spatial coordinates you set on one hypersurface to the next, to the next, to the next, is something that can be characterized in terms of additional quantities. And then, that's part of the whole setup. But that's where you incorporate all of this, you know, freedom and the diffeomorphism invariance of the equations. Yeah. So, yep. Shimo.
Only have to fix h and k on this one slice to about whole space time only valid for compact manifolds.
No.
Another way of asking is, can the nature of the boundaries of the space time really affect the evolution?
Okay. You have non-compact, so you have compact manifolds, you have non-compact manifolds without boundaries, and then you have compact, non-compact manifolds with boundaries. And I don't think I want to talk about those with boundaries, because if you do have boundaries, you would need to place boundary data on them. For example, in empty De Sitter space, you know, you have a boundary at future null infinity, which is, you know, which is a place where you need to specify initial data, not boundary data, if you want to know what's going to happen in your spacetime at all times. So those cases are sort of pathological and difficult to handle. But the types of spacetimes I would want to worry about are the ones that are either asymptotically flat, or maybe asymptotically De Sitter, or asymptotically cosmological. And here there's really no issue of boundaries or putting boundary data anywhere. And then the statement is that, you know, you have a space like hypersurface, which is infinite, on which you place initial data everywhere, and that gives you enough information to evolve forward in time. Are you satisfied? Or?
I just remember reading statements that field configurations at infinity can affect the dynamics.
Right. Well, that happens in empty De Sitter space, for example, and that I would consider to be a rather pathological case where the initial value formulation just fails.
Okay. Here's a book by mathematicians.
Right. Other questions about? Okay. So while that was arguably a very brief discussion of the initial value problem, let's see, we're almost done here, so I think I don't think there's any point in starting the discussion on junction conditions. I think I'll wait for that until next week. So we might as well stop here, but yeah, I'm happy to take questions. Right. Right.
Does all the mathematics carry through? Is this something critically different? Because it seems physically rather a different kind of thing.
Right. So the mathematics would be exactly the same. So if you were given a time-like surface, so here's your sigma, then while the normal direction would be a space-like direction, and those equations, of course, still have to be satisfied, but the interpretation you give them is rather different, because here you're not talking about the time-time component of the field equations, you're talking about a space-space component, and this would be, you know, a combination of space-space, and one of those directions would be time-like. So the math would look identical, but the interpretation that you would give to all those quantities would be rather different. So when I talk about junction conditions, that's precisely going to be the condition that I'll talk about. That's going to be the context for that discussion. But honestly, that's something that I haven't thought about recently, but I did do some thinking about. It's one of those, so it's like an ENM, right? I mean, if you wanted to specify data here, it would be a boundary value problem. And And in ENM, you can do, I mean, for static problems, you can do that easily. You set up your boundary value, your boundary values on a certain boundary, and that constrains the electric field and the, you know, the potentials everywhere else and all of that stuff. If you were to do this in a dynamical context, you would have, I think, to be very careful about putting boundaries here, putting boundary values here, at the same time specifying the initial data here, and make sure that you don't end up with inconsistencies between the prescribed values and what ought to come out from the evolution of this initial data.
Couldn't you do the dynamics temporally instead of spatially entirely? I mean, why do we always choose the data on a space like time surface?
So what you're saying is that instead of trying to even think of specifying initial data here, let's just specify data everywhere on that boundary. And I think the answer is that, well, the nature of the differential equations would in fact tell you that you would not be able to pin down the solution uniquely that way.
How do they know that?
Oh, they still know about the time being different from space. Right, the wave operator has a certain signature, and there's certainly built-in knowledge about that.
There's one time dimension, and there's three space dimensions that we have to think of one way rather than another way. Is that?
Well, that certainly gives you a clear way of distinguishing time from space when the numbers
right.
don't match. If you had one time dimension and one space dimension, which might be a matter of convenience or convention as opposed to something fundamental. I haven't thought much about this, but it's an interesting question. So that would suggest that in one plus one dimension, you might be able to do something like this. Whereas in the, I'm just guessing here because I haven't thought about this thoroughly. But I think those are interesting issues. But I'm pretty confident that, you know, if you were to do it in the usual context of 3+1 dimensions, that trying to specify boundary data on a time-like boundary would not allow you to specify a solution uniquely. You would have to make other statements about what happens, for example, in the asymptotic past. You would have to, you would have to place additional conditions that would be beyond the boundary values that you would like to, like to restrict yourself to. You had another question? Yeah?
So my hypersurface kind of a structure. So would it be destroyed with the resolution?
So for example, you have a space-like surface with a hole in it or something like that, or a handle or, something non-trivial topologically.
Right.
I don't know. Right. So, if you have a topological structure, it's certainly real, and it would be, a part of the initial value problem. But whether that would produce problems with the uniqueness of the evolution, I'm not sure. I don't know. Again, it's an interesting question. Anything else? Okay, so let's quit for today, and I can give you your homework back, and be sure that you give me yours before you leave.